to three parts, just as the steps. You could put this down to a classical education in learning to read Caesar at a very young age. All Gaul is divided into three parts. Ergo, everything is divided into three parts for any kind of classicist. But it will prove very, very useful to think of these three periods. The first period comes after we invent the steppe nomads in that very, very early time before writing. And that period we'll call antiquity. And that's about the first third of the course. It goes to lecture 13. And that deals with interaction of different nomadic peoples with early civilizations, with China, with Rome, with Persia. And that ends in the 6th century AD when there's a new period. And I will call that the early Middle Ages. And that period will stretch from lecture 14 to 25. And the great players in that period are the Turks, the Turkish people who spread across the steppes. They bring their languages. There are now 145 million Turkish speakers in the world today. Most of them concentrated in the Republic of Turkey, Azerbaijan, which is in Iran, and Turkmenistan. And those languages were brought there in the 11th and 12th centuries. That is a result of the success of steppe nomads who brought those languages really from the Mongolian heartland. And the Turks are rather peculiar this way. They lose their homeland, but they win new homelands on the central and western steppes and also in the heart of the Middle East. And that period comes to an end in the 13th century, and we open with the final period, the 13th and 14th centuries, and I like to call this the Mongol era. That's where we will look at the greatest conqueror of all, Genghis Khan, his grandsons, and the Mongol impact on the wider world, the interaction of the nomadic peoples on a hitherto great scale, a much greater scale than ever documented either in the literary records or the archaeology. And with this perspective of the three periods and the three zones, I hope that we can come to an understanding with the peoples of the steppes. And one other point in passing, as we look at time and space, as we go through this course, kick the map around of Eurasia. We are accustomed to looking north. Turn the map around to look south. We're going to look from the nomadic viewpoint. We're going to look at the world as the nomads saw it. And in that case, the nomads are at the roof of the world. And the civilizations go from China to Rome in antiquity. And that vision is going to be premised on most of what follows.
Lecture 2, The Rise of the Steppe Nomads.
In this lecture, I plan to deal with the earliest steppe nomads we know of, and these are peoples dwelling on what we call the Pontic-Caspian steppes, sometimes referred to as the South Russian steppes. And this is a zone I talked about in the opening lecture as essentially the western arm of that great corridor that stretches across Asia, or Eurasia, to be more accurate. The earliest people dwelling there are known from archaeology. We have no writing, and we depend on archaeology and linguistics to understand what actually happened on these steppes, why the horse was domesticated, and who these people were. And this will require us to look at the origins and development of the Indo-European language family. In older textbooks, it was generally known as the Aryan languages, which was a perfectly good term from Sanskrit. Era means noble in Sanskrit. It was used to apply to a great language family in the 18th century by William Jones, the philologist working at Calcutta. At the Asiatic Institute, when he discovered that Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin were related languages. Of course, the poor word got ruined by the Nazis and fascists, and we come up with the cumbersome Indo-European as an explanation for this language family. So we'll look at the evolution of these languages. The second important point is the archaeology, what it tells about the landscape, and above all, the domestication of the horse, and the shift to the pattern of pastoral life characteristic of the nomads that gave rise to that distinct pattern of life and that distinct way of war. So with that in mind, let us move to the question of language first. The study of Indo-European linguistics has been an occupation of Western scholars since the 18th century. And I have to put in a couple of caveats. When you study language families, these should not be mistaken for race. Peoples will change language quite frequently. The speakers of one language, sometimes a minority, will actually assimilate a majority of other people to their language. This has happened many times. Anthropologists have done considerable study on this with modern language families, and there is a theory known as distributed theory or distributed survival theory, and that explains that nomadic peoples are particularly skillful because of their climate, because of their struggle in life, in learning languages and adapting to different language systems. That meant nomads, for instance, who spoke Iranian languages in the period of antiquity, or Turkic languages in the early Middle Ages, or Mongolian languages in the later Middle Ages. They came to learn a variety of other languages. They adopted what are known as loan words, that is, words for items they didn't have in their native language. And they also spread their language as a koine, as a means of communication across the steppes. And you will find in various occasions that the nomads will actually assimilate a larger settled population. This is a theme that will repeat itself throughout this course. We'll see that particularly with Turkish speakers. We believe the same was true of early Indo-European speakers in the prehistoric age where we don't have written records and we depend on archaeology. So it's important to stress from the start that language is not necessarily race in any sense of the word. People speaking a particular language could be from a variety of ethnic and even racial backgrounds. The second important thing that we want to talk about the Indo-European language family is that these relationships have been established by scholars who've studied very carefully the grammar, the phonology, that is the sound systems of Indo-European languages, and they've come to the conclusion that at some point, about 5000 BC, there was a Proto-Indo-European language. PIE is how it's usually abbreviated in scholarly texts. This language is reconstructed. There's a lot of jokes in graduate school about it when you study it. For instance, no one ever really spoke Proto-Indo-European. It was essentially created by scholars. But there is belief that we have some idea of what the parent language was, the mother language of these numerous language families that will spread across much of Asia and Europe. And today, some 75% of the world's population speak as their first language or their main language of communication Indo-European language. And that would include many of the languages of Western Europe, but also languages of India, Iran, and really some quite diverse languages that would not jump to mind immediately. These changes can be studied, and it's predictable how the daughter languages break away, how they evolve into independent languages, mutually unintelligible to the mother language, and then later daughter languages that break away from that mother language PIE, Proto-Indo-European. Based on the best analysis of the languages and the texts available to us, and again, we're looking at written texts that come a lot later than 5000 BC, the oldest written texts of an Indo-European language are the languages of the Hittite or the Anatolian language family. Those are represented in cuneiform tablets from the city of Hattusas in Asia Minor. Roughly, most of these texts date between 1650 and 1190 BC. What it proves is that the Anatolian language family broke away probably first. There are features in its grammar that are very, very archaic, that seem to retain older features that were dropped by the later daughter languages. And it is speculated that sometime between 4000 and 3500 BC, the ancestors of these people moved out of the Caspian Pontic steppes into Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, and brought the Anatolian languages there. Another daughter that broke off is the group of languages known as the Tocharian language family. That was a bit later than the Anatolian. They didn't go west and south. They went east. They apparently peopled the Tarim Basin. That is the basin that has been subject to intensive archaeological study, particularly by Victor Mayer and his team, working with Chinese scholars, who've uncovered these remarkable mummies that show people who have a DNA and ancestry and physical look to the people of Western Europe. And the language that we later know there, the mummies date from anywhere from about 1000 BC to the first century AD. And the languages apparently spoken there were Indo-European languages going back to this early daughter language from Proto-Indo-European, and they're represented by Buddhist texts. Buddhist texts written from approximately the 7th through the 9th century AD. And again, they represent three different distinct versions of that language. So these are two early breaks, and probably breaks from that Pontic-Caspian steppe region. The other breaks in Indo-European languages are later. And this gives rise to a more familiar branch of families, the so-called Centrum branch, the branch that broke off largely in Western Europe. Germanic, Celtic, Italic, Greek, possibly Armenian, are all languages that come out of that branch. Then there's the so-called Satum branch. That would be the branch more easterly. The Baltic and Slavic languages represent a family. The Iranian and the Indic languages, that is the languages based off Sanskrit in much of India, are part of that family. And that again represents changes in the treatment of certain sounds. Above all, the qua sound in Indo-European became a hard K in the Western languages, hence centrum, the word 100 in Latin. In the East, that sound weakened to an S, a sibilant sound, such as sh or s, s, hence satim branch of languages, the 100 in Sanskrit. And therefore, there are other changes that fall with that pattern. So these languages become differentiated by about 2000 BC. The other significant point that comes out of the study of the Indo-European language family is not only the relationship of the languages, but the origins and homeland of the original speakers of Proto-Indo-European. Now, this is controversial, and it's attempting to match linguistic study, very learned study based on ancient texts by scholars who essentially do language, with archaeological evidence. And as I mentioned, there's no writing to help us out, and there's no way, even if you had sufficient skeletal remains to do a very, very careful DNA analysis on these people, there's no way of pinning this to particular racial groups either. I mean, this could get you into very, very dangerous grounds if you start trying to match up bones and material culture with language. But if you study the Indo-European languages and you look at the common cognates, cognate is a word that comes from a Latin word meaning cousins or related. The cognates in all these daughter languages show that the basic vocabulary for horses, for chariots, for wheels, a variety of different types of animals that would be associated with a steppe zone rather than a forest zone or a settled agricultural zone, indicates that these daughter languages, before they broke away, had a common vocabulary for these words, which then evolved into distinct versions of those original words as these groups broke off and settled in different areas. And that locates the region to the Caspian Pontic steppes. And archaeology tells us several important points that are undeniable facts. Around 6500 to 5000 BC, humans moved onto those steppes, and they shifted from hunting and fishing and gathering food to stock raising and seasonal patterns of nomadic life by domesticating various animals, above all the horse. And the horse is that common word, along with wheeled vehicles, that ties those Indo-European languages together. And around 6500 BC, the vast majority of horses to be domesticated are to be found on those steppes. There are very few horses surviving in the rest of Eurasia, in the rest of the old world, in fact. And the species had died out in North America. One estimate is 25%, other estimates are 50% of all horses or equines in the year 6500 BC were in that steppe zone. And therefore, it makes sense that the early Indo-Europeans saw this animal and found out how they could domesticate it and then eventually ride it. And initially, the thought is it was domesticated for winter food. You could slaughter horses in the winter. They can graze under the snow. They can get in under those grass roots. Remember, the grasses are a fantastic carpet over this steppe area. Roots go very deep. They renew themselves. And even in the winter, if those horses can pull up the snow and get down there and feed on that grass, they will survive. It also is a source of mare's milk. And I talked about how that fermented mare's milk was a very, very important commodity for all of these people, starting from the Scythians in the 6th century BC to the Mongolians, the Mongols of the Mongol Empire in the 13th century AD. By 4200 BC, they began to learn to ride the horses bareback to help them herd animals. One experiment is if you're walking on foot with a dog, you can herd maybe 200 sheep at best, probably half that number. But if you're on a horse with a couple of dogs, you can herd 500 or more. That is, it expands the number of animals and the range that you can herd. And so the domestication of the horse between about 4800 BC and 4000 BC was vital. And the speakers of the early Indo-European languages all shared those common words for horse and related items of the horse. Another important invention is the wheel. There's a lot of controversy as to when wheeled vehicles were readily available. The earliest uncontested depictions generally come from the Near East, but already this is a very, very well-known technology. From the Standard of Ur in 2600 BC, we have depictions of clumsy carts that are being dragged into battle by onagers or donkeys, some kind of wild ass, not even by horses. These vehicles, however, are clearly late in the tradition. What we do find in archaeology is people who are identified on the steppes as the Yamnaya culture, and that comes from a major site on the Russian steppes, had learned to harness carts, to get the harnessing equipment, the wheeled carts, harness them to oxen, and create the so-called gares, or a kind of cart that will move your dwellings across the steppes. These are generally frame buildings of felt and hides that you can set up as tents, but you can also actually live on these things when they're mounted on the gare. And the gares are essentially a physical manifestation of the social group known as yurt in Turkish. And so you gain a mobility. You can move all of your possessions in these vast wagon trains drawn by oxen across the steppes. You could herd your animals with horses, and we've got descriptions of these from Herodotus writing in the 5th century BC about the Scythians dragging huge numbers of carts and people across the steppes in search of better pastures, or to exploit seasonal advantages of water, getting away from drought, finding new homes, whatever it be. By perfecting the technology of carts and wheeled vehicles, at some point, it is surmised, and the evidence is really still not there, but the best surmise is people on the steppes invented spoked wheels and fashioned these wheels to what we call the light chariot, which became the weapon extraordinaire of the Middle and Late Bronze Age, from roughly 2000 BC to 1200 BC. The vast majority of depictions of light chariots comes from the Middle East again. They come from historic periods. They come from New Kingdom Egypt, from the Hittite Empire. Yet there's enough evidence coming out of burials from the Altai mountain zone, that is out in the eastern steppes where you get the Altaic languages as a language family, which are the language families of Turkish and the Mongolian languages, of what seem to be these early vehicles. There's evidence also from burials as far west as Poland. Sometime before 2000 BC, some scholars would like to push this back, to 3000 BC. We really don't have the evidence. They perfect the making of the light chariot. And these chariots acted as platforms in battle. Men could ride in. They could attack infantry armies from the flanks. They could ride across the front of an infantry army. They could use a version of the composite bow I described, which is later used by mounted horsemen to disorganize the enemy. And that gave the nomads a new military edge, as well as a mobility for their families, as well as better stock raising. That was the third vital innovation on the steppes, perhaps by 2000 BC, 2500 BC. And by virtue of that, the carts, the stock raising, the riding of horses to herd animals, and the light chariots, the Indo-European speakers started to migrate both west and east. Now, the migrations west will take the ancestors of the speakers of many European languages into the forest zones of Western and Central Europe. It will take him into the Mediterranean world and give birth to the Greek language, to the various Romance languages. In Western Europe, to Germanic and Celtic languages. Those that stay in the original steppe zones and move into the forests of Russia become the ancestors of the Baltic and Slavic peoples. But there was also a great Eastern expansion. And the majority of Indo-European speakers who spread east spoke versions of what is classified as the Iranian language family, or more properly, the Indo-Iranian languages. These people migrated out of that original homeland on the western steppes of the great arm of Eurasia to steppe lands north of the Aral Sea, and then drifted down into Transoxiana, into regions called by the Greeks Bactria and Margiane. And in there, they settled and brought their distinct technology of chariots, the use of domesticated horses, and their language. And that complex in Transoxiana was the original homeland for the ancestors of what became the Iranian speakers and the speakers of Indic languages that gave rise to Sanskrit and eventually to the languages of modern India today, Hindi, Urdu, and what we know. And that migration represented a very important migration of steppe nomadic peoples from the original core area east. Other Iranian speakers went farther east across the Central Asian steppes, as far as the upper course of the Yellow River, the Wangho, in the Ordos area, which is this great loop in the Yellow River, a desert arid area that fades into the Gobi, and they settled in that region. And therefore, the peopling of the steppes was largely a phenomenon brought about by Indo-European speakers moving out of that heartland, brought about first by the introduction of chariots in the late Bronze Age, and middle and late Bronze Age, and later by the perfection of riding horses with saddles, which led to another distribution farther east. So in contrast to the historic periods where we have good written records, the movement of nomadic peoples across Eurasia in the earliest period is west to east. And that's an important point I wish to stress, because that's going to have major repercussions in the upcoming lectures. Now, the early Iranian and Indic speakers who had moved into that area of Transoxiana and northern Iran, those people were in close association for a long time. Scholars who study the Rig Vedas, which are the earliest texts of India in Sanskrit, and the Avesta, particularly the earlier passages of the Avesta, which is a very antique language of Iranian. Scholars have noted close association of these two languages, similarities in cultural patterns, whereby the early Iranians and early Indian peoples, the ancestors of these people, had a sense of caste. They also worshipped a lot of the same gods. And as a result, they broke off in two directions, one to the west, one to the east, and in so doing, they evolved into the later Indian and Iranian peoples. Among the common features we know about is the use of horse sacrifices, the use of soma, which is an alcoholic beverage, in order to get inspired contact with the ancestral spirits. A branch of these people, generally known as the Mitanni, a military elite, and known in the text as the Mariyanana, or the young charioteers, a branch of these people moved actually into the Middle East, into northern Iraq, and they're known from Hittite texts. They were known as great horsemen, and they brought the horse and light chariot into northern Mesopotamia sometime around 1600 BC. Those texts were quite a revelation. It shows that the Indo-European speakers of the Mitanni spoke a language very close to Vedic and Avesta Iranian. And those migrations represent an important migration of the Middle and Late Bronze Age that brought Indo-European speakers into the central steppes, into Iran, and even into the Middle East. The next major migration of nomadic peoples really came as a result of another breakthrough. And that was learning to ride horses in battle, on saddles. The development of the composite bow, which I had talked about in the very first lecture. Sometime after 1000 BC, nomadic peoples on the steppes, almost certainly Iranian speakers, known as Scythians in classical sources and described in detail by Herodotus, they perfected a type of saddle. It didn't yet have stirrups. Some scholars surmise perhaps it had primitive leather stirrups, but they create a saddle that could sit on these superior horses they've been breeding. I guess they something like 13, 14 hands high would be the distance in modern terms. And these horses had a saddle with a wood frame, leather cushions, eventually a tree or a back on it that allows the man to sit up with a composite bow. And that superior saddle, that bow, allowed for the development of horse archers. Once this technique of warfare was known, it led to that second migration of Indo-Europeans, Iranian speakers, from the Central Asian steppes into the Tarim Basin, where the Tocharians had eventually settled. It led to settlements farther east to the fringes of the Chinese Empire. Scythians, or Iranian speakers, from the southern Russian steppes, from the western arm, invaded into the historic civilizations. The first disastrous records we have of this are a group of people known as the Cimmerians, who apparently crossed over the Caucasus Mountains, invaded provinces of the Assyrian Empire, smashed into the Phrygian kingdom of King Midas of the Golden Touch at Gordian. There are records of attacks extending from 716 to 654 BC. And as a result, these Cimmerians disrupted literally the political order of the Near East, which tipped the balance to the emperors of the Assyrians, who united the Near East in the early Iron Age. In Transoxiana, in the Central Asian steppes, we encounter in the classical sources a group of people known as the Sakai. They settled in the region of Ferghana, which I'll be talking about. They enter into the western zones of the Tarim Basin. And so Iranian-speaking peoples moved into the Tarim Basin, and the mummies have proved that a component of Indo-European speakers, or not even Indo-European, a component of people who probably originated from Iran in the Middle East had moved into the Tarim Basin and intermixed with the earlier Tocharian peoples, whose mummies show people with reddish hair, light eyes, whose textiles resemble very much the tartans of Scotland and Ireland, and suggests that these people who probably emigrated during the early Bronze Age now intermixed with a new group of nomads who came in, settled in the caravan cities, adopted eventually the civilized ways of life, and fused into the populations of these western zones that later the Chinese encountered. What is also important is that the Iranian speakers, or the Scythians, if you want to use the Greek term, spread this common way of nomadic life across the whole of the Eurasian steppes. By 500 BC, from the lower Danube to literally the borders of the Manchurian forest, we suspect that a common steppe nomadic way of life now prevailed. That included all the carts, the diet we've talked about, the way of life. Some of these Iranian speakers have now entered into the settled zones. The most successful are the Medes and Persians, who came out of Transoxiana, settled in Iran, and the Persians would go on to build the most successful of the ancient Near Eastern empires, the Achaemenid Empire, which significantly was based on cavalry armies. Other members